Okay, welcome. My name's Kevin Murphy. I'm a plant breeder at Washington State University, and I'll be talking about quinoa. Unlike Deepak, who gave a really nice history of millet, I'm just going to dive right into our project and our research with quinoa. And if you have questions on history and cultivation, et cetera, we can talk about that later. I'd like to acknowledge all my co-authors and collaborators. We ran out of space, or there'd be more there. So I want to break this talk into two sections. First part will be our lessons learned and what we've kind of experienced over the last 6 years. We've been working with quinoa since 2010. And then the second part will be where we go from here. So starting off with the lessons learned, I'll focus on first our breeding and variety trials, and then our agronomic trials, and then finally some end-use quality as well. I would like to acknowledge some of the universities we've been working with as part of our first USDA grant. Utah State University, Jennifer Reeve and Earl Creech. Brigham Young University, so Jeff Mon and Rick Jellin have been quinoa geneticists for 15, 20 years. Really helpful in a lot of this. Oregon State University with Stephen Machado and some folks with eOrganic as part of Oregon State. And then in 2010 at Washington State University, we had one quinoa researcher. Now between graduate students and others, faculty, we've got every year between 25 and 30 working on quinoa. And so this was really the first and most important lesson we learned. In 2010, we grew a variety trial consisting of 44 unique quinoa varieties that we accessed from David Brenner. These here kind of exemplify some of those. Out of those 44, we had 75% of them fail to set any seed, produce any seed. And this is why, photoperiod. And in this picture, this isn't actually of those. This is a population developed from a Peruvian by a Chilean cross. And these are advanced recombinant inbred lines. And the one on the left, lower left corner, let's see if I can find it right here, that's a obligate short day plant. So it just grows about 2 feet tall and makes those leaves and never flowers in our northern climate. The one right next to it, here, this big, tall, purple one. Again, these are sister lines, so very similar. That's a facultative short day plant, so it doesn't want to flower in our long day climates, but it will eventually, and eventually here is early September, which is far too late to then make seed and mature the seed. So that's the reason most of those failed, is they were short day plants, and ours, now we're working towards developing day-neutral or long-day plants, and that's essential to any, like, the first step of any variety. And one of the main issues we've had with farmers, they call all the time and they ask, well, I grew quinoa, I planted quinoa, but it didn't germinate, and then if it did germinate, it grew 10 feet tall and didn't make any seed. And I ask where they get the seed, and it's usually Costco or Walmart or something like that, because one of the major bottlenecks to quinoa production is getting the seed. There's very, very few places you can get enough seed to grow more than 5 acres of quinoa at a reasonable price. So they would go to Costco and buy the seed there, and it turns out it was Bolivian seed, so it had probably been scarified to remove the saponins, and then if it did germinate, it was a short day plant. So that's one thing we're working on. We grow variety. We've been growing variety trials for many years. Usually, the variety trials consist of 25 to 30 varieties. I'm just showing you Washington here and a couple spots in northern Idaho. We also have variety trials in California, Utah, and Oregon in the past. Usually, two locations there per year. But if you look at these circles, you can see the Olympic Peninsula on the west. Those are our little bit wetter areas. But the main thing, they're all kind of in the rain shadow of the Olympic Mountains. So what's really unique about that site is there's a range of temperatures, but a range of rainfall, but also very temperate climate. Doesn't get too hot in the summer. And then the one in the lower central part of the state is the Yakima Valley. We do irrigated quinoa research trials there in Prosser. And then we have some near our Palouse, in the Palouse area, southwest and north Idaho. And that's or southeast, sorry, that's all dry land production. So for the next few tables, I just want to point out I'm going to talk about these three sites. Shimakum, Washington, about 25 inches of rain a year. Albion, Washington, 20 inches of rain a year on the east side. And then Lewiston, Idaho, which is a little bit less and quite warm as well. So these are some of the varieties we grew in these variety trials. And in each location, it's planted the same year, same thing. So this is in pounds per acre. So Titicaca, the leading variety there, was about 3,400 pounds an acre. In Chimicum, so again, that's the west side, no heat stress. We moved to Pullman, where there's moderate heat stress. You can see the yields decreased substantially. And then the third location was Lewiston, Idaho. Lewiston, Idaho is about 2,000 feet lower than Pullman, and it's typically in Fahrenheit about 10 degrees warmer. So it hits 40 degrees C every summer that we've grown quinoa down there for a certain amount of time. And so it's quite hot, and these are the yields we get there. So that's a second major constraint and lesson learned, is we have a lot of zeros in our... And that's one thing we're hoping to do, is figure all this stuff out so farmers don't have to. But this isn't unique to Lewiston. Just watch the top right red cell there. It's also, we got the same in Pendleton with Stephen Machado's trials a couple of years in a row. And Logan, Utah as well, with Earl Creech and Jennifer Reeves' trial. So anywhere where it's that hot, you're running up against some trouble. So heat tolerance is one of our major breeding goals. And in order to reach those goals, one of the things we do is develop new varieties. So this is Adam Peterson. He was my first quinoa grad student. He's making crosses with quinoa here. Leo Hinojosa is a graduate student in the back from Ecuador. He also makes crosses with quinoa. And so this is what we do to develop that diversity, the variation, and then... So these are the first 10 populations Adam made. You can see the female and the male parents there. And now they're F7s. We've got some nice lines coming out of them. But here you can see the yield in the no heat stress location. They're quite high. This is just grams per plot. I'm not just compare them to each other, or really compare them to the yield in the heat stress location. So you think, well, that's a big difference, that's really not good. But what's exciting to us as plant breeders about the yield in the heat stress locations is we planted late, so we hit heat stress perfectly. The really high temperatures, there's the highest recorded temperatures in Pullman ever. And in that same trial, or right next to it, same day planting, same everything, we grew our variety trials, we grew all the parent varieties, and not a single one made a single seed. So we're seeing in those populations actually some heat tolerance coming out, and we've selected from those, and now we have those growing as F7, F8 advanced breeding lines that hopefully will be releasing at some point. In addition to heat tolerance and photoperiod, we're working closely on downy mildew and pre-harvest sprouting resistance. So if quinoa is going to expand beyond the arid northwest or arid west, it's into the Midwest or the East Coast or other places, those two issues are going to be very, very important. I'll show a couple pictures in a minute. We're working on saponin content, high and low. Most of our trials are dry land, so drought tolerance is important. Early maturity is really important in maybe avoiding heat. Seed yield, nutritional value, and flavor we're working on. And then quinoa is a halophyte, so we do some salinity tolerance too. This is a photo of downy mildew. It's the number one disease in quinoa worldwide. And when we grow it in Western Washington, we see it. And I've heard reports of it in other parts of the East, Pennsylvania, for example. I don't know how well you can see this. This is another issue. This is pre-harvest sprouting right here. If you look closely, all those red squiggles, that's quinoa sprouting in the grain after a rain. And so we test this. We select for this on the west side. That's why we have all those Olympic Peninsula trials. One of the reasons is out of the 6 years we've been growing there, 3 years we've had very heavy August rains and a lot of pre-harvest sprouting. So we've been able to identify some varieties that are resistant to pre-harvest sprouting. Okay, that's all the breeding and variety testing I'll talk about, but we do a lot of agronomy work as well. Growers in the U.S. don't really know how to grow quinoa. It's going to be grown different than it is in Bolivia or much of the Andes. And we want to be able to grow quinoa without farmers having to change their equipment. So everything we do with quinoa in our area is we use our barley or wheat planters and combines, etc. So we have with Utah State intercropping and strip cropping trials with clovers and medics and fescues, and if you're interested, there's a nice new paper out there by Hannah Walters on some of that information. Also down below by Christy Buckland, she should have a paper coming out. She's at Utah State there. And then farmers always want to know where to put quinoa in their cropping rotation. So this is the Palouse. This is where we live. There's a couple million acres of wheat, and it's a very winter wheat dominant ecosystem. So where do we put quinoa in wheat? So this picture is of her trials. There's actually a couple trials there, but she's got barley, wheat, and peas, or chickpeas growing in this. And so in all different combinations, so we'll be able to answer that soon as well. And then in Washington, California, Oregon, a lot of growers are really set up to transplant. So we've done transplanting versus direct seed trials. They have the equipment, they have the manpower, they have the know-how. And so what we found is transplanting results in much earlier and higher yielding quinoa. And it's also better, especially if you're an organic grower, to control weeds. It's easier to control weeds because you've got to jump on things. But you can get it in the ground earlier. And so transplanting is a good option. Where transplanting is not an option, we do agronomic research with planting date, seeding rate with the University of Idaho. We work with Kurt Schroeder and Doug Finkelberg there on no-till farms, direct seeded farms, and then also nitrogen fertility. So trying to figure out all these basics for growers, really just trying to figure out how to grow quinoa, and it's different just across the state of Washington, too. Livestock integration. I have a student who's really interested in livestock integration, and so he's added geese to our quinoa trials, some of them. And what we found is if you get the timing right, including ordering geese at the right time and then not raining and you planting at the right time, geese are really good at controlling weeds in quinoa, and they leave the quinoa alone. If you get the timing wrong, they trample everything, and it's a disaster. But either way, you get a nice Christmas goose when you're done. And then we have a lot of irrigation trials. I won't go into those. If you have questions, we can talk about them. But drip and handline and overhead, we'd know when to irrigate and how much that'll bump up yields and things like that. Irrigation can also mitigate heat, which is really important in a lot of Oregon and Washington and Idaho. And then, again, quinoa is a halophyte, and so we've been able to identify quinoa varieties that are more salt tolerant than others and specific to certain salt. And quinoa can grow and make seed in seawater. We grow it in our trials up to 32 decisiemens per meter, so that's very, very salty. For example, wheat or barley, wheat may start to lose yield at 4, barley at 6 decisiemens per meter. And then end-use quality. So this is another thing we've been working quite a bit on. We have a really good group at WSU, University of Idaho, working on end-use quality of quinoa. I'm not going to show a lot on this, but these are some of the traits we work with. And one thing that's unique about that hasn't been done is look at end-use quality traits in a whole bunch of different varieties. And so that's what we're focusing on. And you can just see, I've put them in the red boxes, but the extremes of seed size, for example, or protein, 11 to 17%. We do it for a lot of other traits like cooking time. We have varieties that are 10 minutes and varieties that take 20 minutes. So there's a tremendous amount of variation to select from in our crosses here. And then we do tasting panels, consumer panels, expert panels, train panels, that type of thing, where we look at aroma, color, appearance, taste, flavor, texture, and then overall score. So a couple of things I'll point out here. This first one, QQ74, if you remember, that's one of the most heat-tolerant lines that we have. It has an overall rating of 5.3. Compared to Commercial Red, which is a Bolivian variety, 6.7 is quite a bit lower. So this is what we hope to do, is we release varieties to see what consumers prefer and why, and specifically what parts parts of it are attractive or not. And that'll help us in our breeding program as well. So from here, that's kind of our lessons learned in a nutshell. But where do we go from here? So I'll start where I left off with end-use quality. So one thing that I think is really important is to start market class development. In quinoa, there's really no market classes other than color. So there's red, white, and black, tricolor, that type of thing. But that's it. Nothing like what you have in wheat and other malting barley, for example, and other crops. So that would be extremely helpful for us to do that. And we just had a student finish her project on figuring out, starting to define market class in quinoa. And so here's a cluster analysis based on some of these traits you see up there in the top right. And she defined four, maybe five different clusters. And so those relate to their end uses like bread, cakes, noodle flakes, alcohol. And so if you remember from the previous slide, QQ74, it didn't receive very high ratings in the taste test, but it's a low amylose. It's a very sticky quinoa. It's like sticky rice. And so it has a nice spot. It's actually on the very left one here, but there's a nice cluster of kind of sticky quinoas too. So this is what we're trying to develop with our end-use quality. And we need to do more work on this, but I think it's good. And then the end-use quality will really help us as we release new varieties, which ones we decide. These are just a few advanced breeding lines selected by some collaborators of ours, and Julianne Kellogg, one of my students, took these pictures. These are on the Olympic Peninsula, and these are F7s, 8s. We're hoping to a couple more years and be able to start releasing some U.S. varieties adapted to different regions and for different market classes as well. And then we have some new partnerships that are either brand new or relatively new. I didn't mention earlier, these are thanks to a new USDA NIFA grant. So now we're working with Felipe Barrios Macias at University of Nevada, Reno. He's a physiologist who's going to be helping us with drought and heat tolerance. University of Minnesota, we're working with Craig Schaefer, who's an agronomist there. So that we're moving now out of the West into Minnesota, et cetera. And then, what's that? Oh, University of Idaho, I did mention Kurt and Doug, the work we're doing with them, but we're also working with an economist now for the first time. And then USDA ARS, we're working with Jude Mall in Maryland, and he's going to be doing soil biology and a lot of agronomic trials on the East Coast as well. Another thing we need to do is come up with some novel breeding tactics other than just the straight crosses I was talking about earlier, but do some wide hybridization to bring more heat tolerance into quinoa or maybe bring some downy mildew resistance. And if you look at the lower left, it's a PI accession Chenopodium berlandieri. Chenopodium berlandieri is a allotetraploid. Like quinoa, they share a common ancestor, and you can cross the two. The next picture is Rick Jellin making this collection in New Mexico. David Brenner curated it for several years, and when we asked for it, he sent it to us, and then we made crosses with QQ74. And the idea here is, again, kind of longer term, but trying to get novel traits into our quinoa germplasm while getting rid of the deleterious alleles. Quinoa genome has recently been sequenced by Mark Tester's group and the BYU group as well. Mark Tester's with COST in Saudi Arabia. Okay, almost done. And so with that, I mean, it's brand new information. There's actually a Japanese team that did a draft sequence earlier in the summer. So with all this information now coming out, we'll be able to utilize that into different marker-assisted selection programs, maybe for quality traits or salt overly sensitive gene, things like that, and really help our program as well. And then finally, we do a lot of participatory breeding. The varieties you saw, some of those were selected by our farmer collaborators. And because it is a new crop, we feel this is an important way to get farmers really involved, not just in growing, selecting, but just seeing quinoa in the field and choosing varieties and getting it adopted by farmers maybe more quicker. I mentioned economics already. This is something we really need to focus on. It's a volatile market, and it's a question we get a lot, and I don't know much about it. So hopefully we'll have some information. And then finally, we need to get back to the basics, really, with just learning how to grow quinoa in many different regions of the country, and different cropping systems as well. So we're continuing a lot of agronomic studies on into the future. So our funding, these are our funders. Organic Farming Research Foundation gave us $15,000 in 2010, and ever since then they really set it up. We've had some NIFA grants. We work with Cliff Bar and Lundberg Family Farm. Western Sarah has been really helpful. And then finally, Borlaug Leap. We have a student now in Rwanda. We have projects in Malawi, Rwanda, and Ecuador on quinoa breeding as well. And that's it. So if there's time for questions, I'd be happy to answer some. Maybe one. Yeah, so the question is, what temperature does the seed set become really affected? It depends when, but above 35 degrees Celsius during pollen formation can start to kill pollen or really do that. And so that's one of the things Leo's looking at. It depends on the variety and irrigation. But about 35 is a good rule of thumb. But high temperatures during seed formation is really important too, so you can get a seed, but it'll just shrink into a thin disc and you'll get no yield there either. And that's a little bit higher, maybe 38, 40, that hits that. But give or take.
We'll have to move on to the next speaker. Okay. And I have seen a couple of cameras pop up. Most of these slides are going to be available online, and unless you're a member of the press, you're not allowed to take pictures without the author's permission.